People we gonna rise like the water. Like the water. We're gonna face this crisis. Rise up. I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter.
At the end of last year, I followed a link from a press release that was sent to me, and this is where I landed. People gonna rise. It's a video featuring members of a local activist group called Wasatch Rising Tide. The song will be familiar to some members of the activist community out there, but this was the first time I'd heard it. I've since learned that it's been an anthem at various climate actions around the country and the world for years. This version was being sung by college-age adults gearing up to enter the Salt Lake City headquarters of the Bureau of Land Management. They were protesting recent oil and gas lease auctions on public lands in Utah, and their message, like the message of so many climate activists, was simple and direct.
Saying, keep it in the ground.
Keep it in the ground. I'm Roger McDonough, and this is In the Hive. 2018 saw more oil and gas leasing on Utah public lands than we've seen for more than a decade. It was also the year that the global scientific community further expanded its understanding of the impacts of climate change that comes primarily from the burning of fossil fuels, like the oil, gas, and coal extracted from Utah public lands. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a report late last year laying out the effects of just 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. It's not exactly a pretty picture, but the IPCC says it's a better target than the 2 degrees of warming we're currently supposed to be trying to avoid. But despite years of public awareness campaigns and big strides in renewable energy, 2018 saw the largest global carbon emissions on record. That includes a 3.5% increase in emissions here in the United States. Which is to say that despite a lot of goodwill, a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of best intentions, we're still failing pretty miserably when it comes to solving what is perhaps humanity's biggest crisis ever.
I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter saying, keep it in the rise up.
At the action at the BLM offices here in Salt Lake City, Wasatch Rising Tide delivered a letter to the Utah Bureau of Land Management calling for an end to fossil fuel extraction on public lands. 4 people were arrested at that protest. Those arrests brought to mind another climate activist, Tim DeChristopher. Just over 10 years ago, DeChristopher walked into a BLM oil and gas lease auction where more than 100 parcels of southern Utah public land were going to be leased. He registered as a bidder and then began to bid. And bid. And bid. He ended up with winning bids on 14 parcels of land and a bill for $1.8 million. That was a bill he never intended to pay. DeChristopher's act of civil disobedience eventually bought him 21 months in prison. So a decade on, what does DeChristopher think the role of activism is in trying to combat climate change, especially given our failures as a species to address the problem? Early last month, Tim spoke with me from his home in Rhode Island via Skype, and I started by asking him if the protest that garnered him fame and prison time was, at its core, a climate protest.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely my primary motivation, you know, and that auction represented sort of a confluence of several different factors, including the public lands issue that obviously is very salient in Utah, and participatory democracy, where the public had largely been locked out of the decision-making process for this public property. But really the driving factor for me was that drill now, think later mentality that was driving the climate crisis and our general unwillingness to take that threat seriously and do what we needed to do to put ourselves on the path to a livable future.
By the time of DeChristopher's action in 2008, scientists had already been warning for decades about the consequences of climate change. And every year, more climate-causing emissions enter the atmosphere makes the task that much harder. I asked DeChristopher about that disconnect between what science warns is needed and what is actually happening, and what regular people, meaning people who aren't directing policy, should do in the face of that reality.
You know, the first answer that I come to is that regular people, when faced with this issue, grieve. And I think that's an important part of our response at this point, you know, that it's not 1992 anymore. It's not even 2008 anymore, when everyone was saying this is our last best chance to stop this crisis. You know, the task ahead of us 10 years ago was incredibly daunting. And now it's far beyond what is even thinkable, really, for us to respond to this crisis. And all of the science over the past decade has gotten worse. And we've already started seeing those impacts in really real ways, both here and around the world. And so I think there's an internal transition that we have to be going through to grapple with that reality and to be able to hold the paradox where we have in some ways lost the fight, and yet the fight is more important than ever, where we have to be able to grieve for what has already been lost and what we've already committed to losing. And at the same time, we need to fight harder than ever to try to minimize how great that loss will be.
To some extent, DeChristopher is talking about the world he and others in the climate movement were trying to save versus the world that is now possible to save. I asked Tim about the continuous but largely ineffective measures to shake people and perhaps more importantly government leaders awake to the reality of the diminishing returns from delaying action on climate change.
You know, we have to admit at some point that we don't have an answer to that question, and that when that's our task, when that's what we seek to do, is wake people up or whatever, we're going to fail, and we're going to be brokenhearted, and we're going to feel like completely useless. And I think it's far more empowering and perhaps more effective, rather than ask the question of what can we do to get other people to change, to look at ourselves and say, what do I feel a moral responsibility to do at this time and with this information that I know? And that responsibility for us is not dependent necessarily on what others do. Other people's ignorance does not justify our inaction. Like, we know what we are called to do on some level. And going about doing that without an expectation that we're going to change other people's minds, I think, is not only the only way to do this and maintain our sanity, but also paradoxically, usually more effective at actually influencing change.
Tim's comments here reminded me of civil rights activists who talked about leading with righteousness. But I wondered if people's moral actions were sometimes driven by a sense of their own posterity for being remembered for doing the right thing. What would guide them if they were confronted by a civilizational crisis like climate change, a crisis that could conceivably spell the end of history?
It's not all that different from that sentiment about being remembered. You know, a lot of my work over the past few years has focused on our relationship to our mortality and how that's connected to the climate crisis. And I worked for a while as a hospital chaplain. And one of the things I saw in that experience is that even people who are taught to have sort of this outcome-oriented perspective, when their loved one is in a terminal situation, when it's clear that their parent or their spouse or whoever is going to die, you know, nobody sort of washes their hands of that relationship and says, okay, well, then I guess that's over because the outcome is they're going to die. That's when they care most deeply and most lovingly for that loved person, when they make the most effort to show how much they care. And it's not about, you know, how that person is going to remember them, because that person is about to die. It's about being authentic to that love that we feel for someone.
DeChristopher is still engaged in climate battles. He runs the Climate Disobedience Center from his home in Rhode Island, which means he hasn't entirely despaired in the face of ongoing defeat, for lack of a better word. I asked him what gives him hope.
What gives me hope is the resiliency of the human spirit, and the ways that we are able to make meaning and make beauty and act out of love in worlds that are very different than the the sort of baseline of comfort that has become to define the middle class American experience. You know, long before we had the sort of comfort and stability of our modern society, people were able to have meaningful and affectionate and purposeful lives. And even in some dire situations, that human affection and capacity for beauty still shines through. And, you know, one of the things that has been resonating with me recently was this short video that went viral after the latest California wildfires, in which this father was driving his three-year-old daughter basically through a wall of flames on either side. They were stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic, and it was, you know, the kind of situation where a lot of people did die in these fires. And she's saying, "Daddy, are we going to burn up? Is the fire going to get us?" And he's saying, no, we're going to make it. And he starts to sing to his daughter to keep her calm as they're driving through these walls of fire. And when the situation around them looks as bleak as could possibly be. And that's the kind of thing that really gives me hope, that no matter how bad our situation gets, there is still that beauty in the human spirit that is going to continue to make our lives rich and meaningful.
Part of Tim DeChristopher's response here about finding meaning in what may become a less comfortable world also sounded like a way forward in addressing climate change, that being willing to sacrifice some level of comfort is also a requirement for addressing the crisis. I asked Tim if he saw it that way as well.
Absolutely. And I think having those experiences outside of the normal, comfortable industrial life is critical to maintaining a sort of ballast as we navigate this period of disruption. You know, and I'm reminded that what first brought me out to Utah was a job working in wilderness therapy out in the West Desert of Utah, which I did for my first couple of years out there. And in that, you know, we were living out in the West Desert near Dugway Proving Ground under tarps. You know, we would rig up a tarp shelter off of a juniper tree, you know, and sleep under that. And all of our food was cooked in little metal cups on a fire that we made with a bow drill, you know, and it was a very different style of living. And the specifics of that program are not necessarily analogous to what the hardships will be from the climate crisis. But having experiences of detaching ourselves from the things that society tell us are what provide us with security and what we should be seeking in our lives, I think offers a sort of confidence and resiliency to know that we can exist in rich and meaningful ways outside of what we've come to know and expect.
In addition to 2018 seeing the most emissions that have been recorded in a given year, here in Utah, we also saw the biggest public lands lease auctions since the one that Tim DeChristopher disrupted a decade ago. The BLM, under the Trump administration's energy dominance policy, has ramped up its oil and gas leasing on public lands in the state. And the December action by the group Wasatch Rising Tide, which we highlighted at the beginning of the show, was to protest the largest such auction since the Bush administration. I asked Tim DeChristopher for his response to the ongoing leasing program.
Well, it's certainly frustrating and disheartening to see that we're still at this point 10 years later and still offering those leases, because it didn't have to be that way. You know, part of the reason I took that action right as Obama was coming into office after he had already won election was because his presidency and the fact that at that time we had Democrats controlling the House and the Senate offered some potential to actually reconsider our energy policy, you know, and instead Obama came in with an all of the above sort of energy policy that focused on energy independence rather than addressing climate change. And for 8 years, his administration resisted the calls from really across the climate movement to not only overhaul our energy system in general, but specifically to scale back and end that federal leasing program. You know, and it was just a few weeks ago that the Department of the Interior report finally came out showing that federal leasing program is responsible for over 25% of the emissions in the United States overall. And that's what the Obama administration had the opportunity to do something about and never had the political will or the courage to do it, despite a huge amount of pressure. In response to the Keep It in the Ground movement by a wide range of climate organizations across the country that were protesting every single one of these lease auctions, the Obama administration, rather than scale these programs back, took them underground and put them all online so that the public didn't have an opportunity to engage, and that the public voice of dissent could not be heard. And that's really what set the stage then for the Trump administration to come in and pretty much do whatever they want and hand all of these lands over to the fossil fuel industry.
Finally, zooming out from the specific issue of oil and gas leasing on Utah public lands, I asked Christopher what the roadblocks were to our addressing climate change at a global scale.
Politically entrenched interests are certainly a big part of it. But I think everyone has entrenched interests. Like, that's the problem, that that all of us are entrenched in this status quo. It's certainly the fossil fuel industry has the most to lose from a transition to a livable future and has done some of the greatest political crimes to keep us committed to catastrophe. But, you know, really we see a wide range of denial, avoidance, and apathy across our society and across our political spectrum. And I think that comes from a wide range of motivations and fears, and it's hard to reduce it to one or just a few things.
Again, that was climate activist Tim DeChristopher. In its October report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said that limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius would require rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society, and that doing so would have clear benefits for natural ecosystems and people. At the beginning of the show, I mentioned the press release that brought me to the climate protest by the group Wasatch Rising Tide. I got another press release this month with some language that was relevant to the conversation Tim DeChristopher and I had. It was from the University of Utah, and it was highlighting a new effort to help with the transition away from fossil fuels, in particular, coal. Natalie Gochner is the director of the Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah, a data-focused economics and public policy research group. The Gardner Institute is a go-to source for economic and demographic forecasting in the state, and its research is frequently cited by Utah lawmakers and the governor's office. The press release described something called the Utah Coal Country Strike Team. And the quote from Natalie Gochner that struck me was, "We've all benefited from coal, but we face an economic, environmental, and moral imperative to combat global climate change." As you'll hear from our discussion, that moral imperative also includes not leaving people behind who for generations have been tied to the coal industry. For disclosure's sake, I'll also mention that Natalie Gochner is one of the volunteer hosts of the KCPW political program, Both Sides of the Aisle. I spoke to her last week at the Gardner Policy Institute in Salt Lake City. As we know, the big driver for climate change is the burning of fossil fuels. And so we've seen these global accords struck. We saw the Clean Power Plan from the Obama administration. There have been a lot of efforts to transition us as a society, as a species, away from fossil fuels. As we make that transition, though, people are losing out, people in very specific regions, coal country. You, in an op-ed in the Deseret News, write that the benefits of getting off of coal are widespread, but that the costs of doing that are very concentrated in these areas. Natalie, you are part of a group at the University of Utah that is looking at this because you are part of a competition, the Alliance for the American Dream competition. This group is called the Utah Coal Country Strike Team. What does it aim to do, Natalie?
Well, so this is a competition to raise incomes of America's middle class or provide more access to the middle class. And again, it's a competition, so we didn't start out in coal country. But at the Gardner Policy Institute, our staff got together and said, if we're going to help Utah's middle class, what would we do? Where would we go? So we're, you know, very savvy in terms of economic data and current conditions. And it didn't take us long to recognize the economic hardship that is Carbon and Emery County. It's about 90 minutes away from Silicon Slopes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm picking that as a midpoint of our urban area.
I mean, it's a midpoint of our urban area, but it's also, it plays into what your strike force, this team involved in this competition, aims to do. I mean, you have a sort of 4-point plan, and part of that involves, you know, creating a new tech environment for these counties. Can you talk about what the 4-point plan is in this competition?
Yeah, sure can. So we've got a coal country strike team. When I say strike team, I want all of the listeners to think of a Navy SEAL team, but for public policy. So multidisciplinary, mission-focused, very well-resourced, just like if you had a very important military assignment. So the assignment here is to raise incomes in Carbon and Emery County. And you know you have to do that by transitioning or diversifying the economy. So as a team, we first looked at what are the economic assets there. We know what the challenges are. And by the way, the challenges are twofold. It's coal mining, but they also have 2 coal-fired power plants. Mm-hmm. Some people have the coal, but they don't have the power plants. Some people have the power plants, but not the coal. This place has both.
And so diversification becomes an even more crucial part of
exactly.
what they do.
Exactly. It's a world of hurt. It's what J.D. Vance in the Hillbilly Elegy called a hub of misery. And I tell people, if we knew that Hill Air Force Base were going to shut down, we would be all out providing resources to help transition that important part of our state that's so dependent on that base. Well, we have the same thing with these coal-fired power plants, Hunter and Huntington. They're scheduled to close the next 10 to 15 years. So on that end, we did an inventory of the strengths in the area, and they are many. So unlike some areas where there really isn't a market for something to happen, you know, once you lose a natural resource, in Carbon and Emery County, they have proximity to the urban area, only 90 minutes away from Lehigh.
Right.
They have broadband access to every home and business. That's better than Salt Lake City has. It's just during the good times they put in broadband. They have a university campus there. USU Eastern has a beautiful campus there. It's what some people would know as the College of Eastern Utah before it became part of the USU satellite campuses. So we think there's an incredible opportunity for a tech center to emerge in that area. So we would like to help train people in IT certifications. We want to start a coding boot camp down there. We would take some of the resources at the University of Utah, some online resources and whatnot to help train people. And then there's all sorts of other tech-related, but not coding per se, but whether it's the creative fields, you know, desktop publishing or whatever, but where we could provide micro-credentials certifications that help these people have gainful employment.
Tourism is also part of this.
It is. Something we call Red Rock Gateway. Keep in mind, we're in a competition, so we got to make it sound right. So we got Silicon Slopes Eastern. That's what we call that. And then we have Red Rock Gateway. But this is a recognition that they have the Wedge Overlook. If people are familiar with that, it's our mini little Grand Canyon in Utah, the San Rafael Swell, 9 Mile Canyon, the Book Cliff Mountains, the Green River, the San Rafael River, the Price River. They have some beautiful assets there. So we think that there is a tourism future in the Carbon and Emery County, and they need to invest in infrastructure to make the most of that. So we would like to have a tourism infrastructure fund that helps with this area.
You also talk about revitalizing housing stock to create a more attractive community, and that in itself would foster more growth. And then finally, the last point was a customized economic incentive. So what do those look like? Is this a state incentive to redevelop the area?
Right. Again, we're trying to raise incomes. We're looking at this area, and we're recognizing that it's contracted in 9 of the past 10 years. It's been in a recession for 9 years.
Which is the opposite of the rest of the state.
Yeah, it's not intuitive because we've had a very strong economy. So this is a pocket of our state that's contracting, and that means the economic development incentives aren't working there. So I talked to a lot of people, and we came to the conclusion that existing incentives aren't working and they need to be pretty much blown up. Strong word.
Yeah, and start from scratch.
Yeah, and so we call it a Blanca Rosa kind of start from scratch kind of thing. But the key is that this area is different. It is its own economy. It's a region down there. It has its own market, if you will. And so you want to customize incentives to this unique place. Many people will be familiar with opportunity zones. They were part of the tax cut, tax reform under the Trump administration, but they created an incentive to invest capital gains in areas of the country that are needy, for lack of a better term, and there is one in Carbon County. So when we say custom incentives, what we're talking about is taking the opportunity zone there and creating an opportunity fund that works for that area.
Can I ask, if you don't, you know, if the Coal Country Strike Force, if you don't win, I mean, you've got these ideas to do this, but if the funding doesn't come through, will you still pursue? I mean, will this strike force carry on? Yeah. What will happen?
So I'm just proud to say that at the Gardner Policy Institute, we have a staff priority to serve underserved populations in our state. We selected this as our staff project for the next couple of years. We're committed to it with or without the funding. And so we've already, you know, created our ideas. We've made several visits. We took 28 people down there on our staff for a visit. So we've become familiar with the area. It has to be locally led, and we're not advocates for it, but we're a support team. We're a technical resource to the people there. And so we'll be there for them one way or another. If we get the funding, it's just going to be a much better.
Sweetens the deal. I know you have buy-in from the mayor of Price. We're talking about the transition away from coal in a general and broad sense, and that's because of economic drivers, also because of policy decisions that have been made. I could imagine a scenario in which the coal industry in particular and some representatives of the state legislature even might be reticent to the idea of transitioning away from coal. You're looking at a sort of economic reality, though.
We are, and I'll tell you that I have felt nothing but the support of people that we've interacted with. So Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox is a co-chair of this effort. Congressman John Curtis is a co-chair. Mayor Corianos of Price City is a co-chair, and Danny Van Wagner is the mayor of Castledale. He's also a co-chair. So I've got these four honorary co-chairs. After that, we've got school districts part of our team, Emory Telecom's part of our team, the local hospital down there. It's very much locally led. You'll see some action on Capitol Hill from the representatives from that area to try and stimulate some investment as well. So while you might think it's counterintuitive that people in coal country want to fight climate change, I think what I see more are people who are very hardworking. They're very committed to their community, and they see that they must change. I think when you've had a 41% decline in coal production since 2001, you have to do something.
Well, when will you find out? When will you find out whether or not you've been given the award?
Yeah, we're in New York City in June, okay. But we're working with a team of people from the Alliance for the American Dream, who are going through our proposals, strengthening it. These people know what they're doing. They'll refine it and help us get it to a really good place. Again, we're going to do it whether we do or not. And I'll just tell you, to me, the reason I'm doing this, the reason I'm so excited about it, is I've met the people. They're very kind-hearted people. They love seeing the University of Utah as a flagship university and as a part of being a public university to serve them. And if you could listen to the mayor of Price, who is an operations foreman or supervisor at the Huntington Power Plant, right out of high school he started as a power plant worker, and now he's gone his career there. But when he talks about his employees and the people that are younger than he is, he says, I'm doing this for them. And that's the same reason that brings me to the table.
Utah Coal Country Strike Team aims to change the way of life in Utah's Emory and Carbon counties with massive intervention, which is reminiscent of the IPCC's October report, saying that preventing devastating warming requires rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. So how big of a change in your way of life are you willing to accept? Weigh in at our Facebook page or email comments@kcpw.org with your thoughts, and we might feature them in an upcoming show. You've been listening to In the Hive on KCPW, and that's all the time we have for today. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next week.